like Windows because they think it's vulnerable to hacking. You probably have a pretty secure firewall and you've never had any problem along those lines, Roy.
Well, the number one thing is you have to learn not to click on things that you don't know what you're clicking on. I get all kinds of weird emails that looks like it's, I get every so often I'll get a pseudo PayPal notice that says that my information needs to be updated and wants me to click on a button that looks like it's going to PayPal, but it really goes to a completely different site. So you need good software, you need good antiviruses, but you also need to have a good head on your shoulders. Don't go clicking where you shouldn't be clicking.
So when you get one of those, you just put it in the circular file and you don't click on it?
I mean, at this point, it's almost a reflex action because they all copy from each other. So you can kind of, after the first few times you've gotten that type of an email, the details change a little bit because everyone puts their own special spin on it. There was a recent news report that some 97-year-old woman got email saying that they had snooped on her watching pornography, and if she didn't send them bitcoins, they would publish videos of her watching porno. And that was funny.
Can you sometimes get a clue by looking at the return address and realize it's something strange?
Fortunately, no, because the easiest thing to do is to spoof the return address. What you probably best to do is if your mail client has the ability to read the link of the buttons that are showing up as HTML, because if you go near it but you don't click it, and it instead of saying paypal.com, it says some gibberish as a domain, that's a kind of dead giveaway that you're sent some, these are scammers. But unfortunately, spoofing is very easy. Caller ID spoofs all the time. Mail spoofs all the time. I regularly get email that seems as though it came from me.
You said you go near it, but don't click on it. What does that mean, go near it?
You can hover your cursor over it without clicking on it, and that won't actuate anything, but it will usually, given the client, show you the domain that little button is going to send people to. So you can hover over things just as long as you don't hit that little left mouse click.
And if you do hit that click, you set in motion malware installation or something like that?
It depends upon the scam. The most recent one that I saw was basically a fake PayPal. They probably don't inject any malware because that's somewhat more difficult and much lower yield. They're much better off socially hacking you. So they'll present you with a page that looks for all the world like a PayPal page, and it'll say, okay, we really need your information to update our records. Please insert your password and your account name. And if you do that, they record your account name and your password, and they get in, and they transfer all of your money and such.
Not very friendly. Okay, Roy, we're about to go over to Science Talk and Mailbag. And you've got it, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW.
Okay, very good, Dick. I want to remind people, as per usual, if you have a mailbag question for Dick, or if you have any topic, questions, statements, answers, and maybe even a puzzler or two, because I could always use those, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@alphacharlie2golfsierra.com. That's my call sign, and that's also my domain. Anything that I talk about, for the most part, I will list on my link page, which is roy.ac2gs.com. Again, roy.ac2gs.com. And just a short while ago, I got an actual mailbag question for you, Dick. So I will read it, and you can do your thing on it. The question is, the gentleman went to a website that calculated an inductance for a loading coil he was interested in for the base of a half-wave, 6-meter vertical monopole. The results he got was 1.2 microhenries. He wants to know how to calculate the number of turns and the diameter of the coil in order to build such a coil.
Yeah, the best I can recommend is that in the early couple of chapters of the Radio Amateur's Handbook, ARRL has a formula where you plug into the formula the number of turns, the diameter of the turns, the spacing of the turns, the diameter of the wire. You plug in the information to that formula, and it tells you exactly how many microhenries you're going to get. So therefore, with that formula in the Radio Amateur's Handbook, you can try various combinations, like if you decide you're going to wind that coil in a piece of PVC tubing that's 1 inch in diameter, and you can, from that formula, easily select how many turns is going to give you the number of microhenries you're looking for. That's the best suggestion I know of, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW.
QHUC with a comment.
Thank you, sir. Yes, HUC, please, comment.
Well, if said gentleman is equipped with an iPhone, there is a rather handy application group called RF Toolbox that he can download. I think it costs about $12. And it has exactly what Dick is talking about. You put in the microhenries that you want and the type of core that you're using, and it tells you what diameter the core needs to be and how many how many wraps it requires, and has a bunch of useful stuff like that. So that's what I would recommend. KD2HUC, back to net.
Okay, that's a good suggestion. There are a lot of applications, cell phone applications, that have programmable calculators that have functions like that. I pointed the gentleman to a website where he just has to plug in some numbers and he gets out the number of microhenries, and by tweaking the number of turns and the length and diameter and such, he can have the number of microhenries that he needs. So, you know, it's all good. There's a whole bunch of different ways of using equations, and these are just a few of them. Okay, before I get into puzzles and such, I know there's at least one person out there with a question. So if anyone has any science questions, feel free. Now's the time, now's the place. Just hit the push-to-talk button.
Yeah, WH4OY, I got one for you.
Okay, Joe, hit me with your best shot.
Okay, explain the mathematical proof behind the Bessel function.
Oh, gosh. You really want something like that? I don't even know if you can do this over the radio. This is something that has to be actually written down. Bessel functions are very interesting things. They're cylindrical differential equations, apparently, and they have all kinds of good uses for electronics and other things. But this strikes me as a little on the esoteric side, and even if I was a math professor, which I certainly am not, I don't know how I would begin to explain it only on a radio. That's the problem with radio. There's YouTubes on the subject. There's wikis that have graphs and demonstrations of what a cylindrical a coordinate system is, and Bessel functions are differentials of that. But I for the life of me, if you wanted to stump me, I probably could spend the next month reading through Bessel functions and still not give you a decent presentation over a radio.
Okay, well, let me narrow that down and see if this makes any more sense. With an FM carrier that's being modulated with an audio tone, as you increase the level of that audio tone, say it's 1,000 hertz, you're going to get it first. If you look at the FM carrier on a spectrum analyzer, you're going to get a first dip at an exact certain amplitude, which equals so much deviation for that first dip. I guess that's what I was sort of getting at, because that's where really the question sort of applies to. And I believe the number is, I was told 2.4048, I thought it was 2.408. So I may be wrong, maybe I missed a digit in there, but that's sort of what I was getting at. Not too much more than that. If it's harder to explain, then just pass it by.
Okay, well, Joe, your question is probably much more suitable to an electrical engineer than an internist who likes to read science books. So I can't give you the specific answers. Maybe Dick can. Bessel functions are interesting things, and there's lots of very nice mathematic YouTubes that go into a visualization of them. And mathematics, surprisingly, is a very visual field. If you're doing it only by talking on the radio, other than simple stuff as far as I'm concerned, like cosines and tangents and Pythagorean theorem, once you get kind of beyond that into differentials, it's very problematic to do this over the radio. So I'll ask Dick if he can answer Joe's question, because it strikes me as a very electrical engineer type of question.
The wording of Joe's question was, it sounded like he wanted to know the derivation of the mathematics called Bessel functions of the first kind. And if that could be delivered to him, it wouldn't do any good. You don't really want the derivation, you don't even want the equation. I've once programmed the Bessel function equation into my Hewlett-Packard 52 calculator, and I could calculate that to 10 decimal places, but you're much better off going to a good reference, and there's a number of websites and a number of books like Reference Data for Radio Engineers where they present to you a graph of the Bessel functions. And you'll see the J0, the J1, the J2. And what that really means is that for a certain, it's an XY plot, for a certain horizontal axis, which is called modulation index, it's not quite deviation, modulation index, delta F over F sub M, you'll see that the at something like 2.4 in the fraction, the carrier drops out, the first side lobe drops out at something a little bit bigger than that, and those dropouts at a very specific amount of deviation is an extremely good way of calibrating a system. If you wanted to set up your repeater so that when you spoke into the microphone, it deviated exactly plus or minus 5 kilohertz, that calibration procedure would allow you to get there with the better than 1% accuracy. Those Bessel nulls, which are plotted as a graph and also plotted as a spreadsheet with the right reference, that's the bottom line of what you're looking for when you're doing calibration of deviation. And Carson's rule also allows you to come up with a very good approximation as to how broad the signal will be when it has that particular deviation. Is that some of what you're looking for, Joe? W2LYY, K2LAW.
I believe so, because I had a discussion with Lou NY2H on the East Frequency a couple of days ago about this, and he said I'd have to go on Google and go look up the exact number. I thought it was like 2.408, I guess it's 2.4048, but that's small indifference. It was just basically a discussion on a way of self-checking your service monitor to know that it's putting out, it's reading deviation correctly. And I said, once you know that number, since you have a ratio compared to 1,000 hertz, you can use that as a ratio to get another null at like 5 kilohertz. You'd have to change your frequency to something like 2076.4 hertz. And at that frequency, you'll get a null exactly at 5 kilohertz of deviation. It was just a conversation to be able to self-check your service equipment to make sure it's reading correctly. That's where it all comes from.
VDH with a comment.
VDH, go ahead.
Yeah, Dick, you're absolutely right. It is the delta F over FM, the deviation over the modulating frequency. When it's 2.4048, it happens again up around 5.52. Again, but when you hit those ratios of delta F over FM, J sub zero of beta, J sub zero, which is the amplitude of the carrier spectral line, it nulls out. So yes, you can use that as a calibration. Also, if you want to play around with some of the other mathematics of it, you can get an expansion or a reference for some of the Bessel functions by thinking of it in terms of sine omega t. In other words, the sine of a sine wave, where the argument of the sine wave is another sine wave. You can see that's basically where the FM signal comes from. So you can expand that, which is not easy, but that gives you some idea where it comes from. Go ahead.
And what you're now describing is the equation that describes the procedure taking place inside of your voltage-controlled oscillator that does the FM modulating, that really creates the FM. And life gets a little bit more complicated when you're not doing this with a pure sine wave. In the real rig, you've got a speech clipper which stops you from over-deviating. So therefore, what you're putting in might not be a pure sine wave. And if what you're putting in is not a pure sine wave, I'm not sure that the nulls fall in the exact same place. Is that true, VUH, K2RIW?
Oh, if it's not a pure sine wave, it's a mess. All of the stuff about the Bessel functions and everything is for pure, a single tone sine waves. If it's a complex general equation, it is very, very complicated. Go ahead.
When you read some of the articles about the history of FM, and Mr. Armstrong had an awful lot to do with it, filed the original patents, and he eventually committed suicide in 1954 because he wasn't being given enough recognition with the FM broadcast, and he set up that tower in New Jersey. Can't think of the name of the town right now. In the beginning, people believed that FM would be impossible because frequency modulation as opposed to amplitude modulation has got this peculiar characteristic. If I've got an amplitude modulated transmitter and I whistle a 1KC note into the microphone and I look at the spectrum on my PAN adapter or my spectrum analyzer, I'll see the carrier term, I'll see a 1KC higher and a 1KC lower sideband and nothing else. If I'm FM modulating the signal, there'll be 1KC upper sideband, 1KC lower sideband, there'll be a 2KC. There's an infinite number of sidebands with FM modulating. You always have an infinite number of sidebands. And the early mathematicians predicted that and said, hey, we can't use this. It'll be all over the place. That's sort of true. But in reality, what happens is except for the first two or three sidebands, they fall off extremely fast in amplitude. And if you strip them away by way of a bandpass filter, very little detriment takes place. So FM is really a very viable technique. What's unique about FM, though, is that in the case of AM, when you're doing high-level modulation in the final stage, you're putting in extra power. A 1 kilowatt transmitter requires 500 watts of audio, and that 500 watts of audio turns out to be 250 watts going into the upper sideband, 250 watts going into the lower sideband, and the carrier is always there. Let me drop. In FM modulation, the power output is constant. At certain levels of deviation, all the power goes into the sidebands and the carrier goes to zero. Kind of a complicated process as to why it does that. On the upper half of the sine wave, you're producing in-phase components, and the lower half of the sine wave, you're producing out-of-phase components, and the carrier gets canceled at a particular deviation. So all the power goes into the sidebands and the carrier disappears. And at some other deviation, the first side lobe disappears and so on. So there's very predictable, by way of those Bessel functions as a curve, you can see where each one of them are going to drop out. And as long as you're putting in a pure sine wave, it gives you a very exact method of calibrating because mathematically speaking, that technique is good to 12 decimal places. Over to you for any further comments on this show. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, I have no comments. As I said, it was just a conversation I had with Lou and Y2H, because he said he wanted to be able to use his service monitor to, you know, check, you know, the repeater. And I said, well, the first thing you do is make sure your service monitor is reading deviation accurately. If you know that, then you can use it as a good example of, knowing that it's accurate and you're not going to be making measurements falsely.
When a repeater for amateur radio service is properly set up, I think we come very close to plus or minus 5 kc of peak deviation for full amplitude. Is that approximately correct, Joe, to your knowledge?
Yes, it depends on exactly how you set your peak deviation. A lot of manufacturers will tell you to set your, they'll recommend that you set your peak deviation at 1,000 hertz at maybe 4.5 or 4.6 or 4.75 or something like that, not exactly at 5. Sometimes you set it at 5, you'll find other frequencies, lower frequencies, may make it actually look like it over-deviates. And, and he asked me also a question about bandwidth, and I forgot the formula, but I remembered it quickly. It comes back to be for a standard commercial radio, they use it like in business bands, which is a lot of this commercial equipment we use for amateur purposes is done the same way. He asked me what the bandwidth was. In a simple formula, I believe it's 2 times the deviation plus 2 times your highest audio frequency. Simple way to remember that, if you forget the formula, and FCC designates these radios as 16F3.
Does that mean it's roughly 16 kilohertz wide?
Yes, 16 kilohertz bandwidth, correct.
So if we deviated 5 kc with a 3 kc amount of audio, that would be plus or minus 8, 16 kc, and so on. That's it's called Carson's Rule, and the Carson's Rule is an approximation, but it's amazingly accurate for reasonable amounts of modulating frequency and deviation. It comes very, very close. And so if you Google the word Carson's Rule, you get a couple of very nice articles that explain how it all works. Back to Roy, AC2GS, K2RIW.
Thank you very much, Dick. Thank you, Joe. Carson's Rule, fascinating subject. As you mentioned, Dick, it makes the assumption of continuous waveform. So sine waves, it would work beautifully for, and square waves, it wouldn't work at all. But thankfully, most signals aren't square waves. Bessel functions were discovered by a great mathematician called Laplace, and if you have nothing better to do and you like to read up on history, you might want to read up about some of the many things that he discovered. And even to this day, just a couple of weeks ago when Wesley was talking about cylindrical waveforms, it entails Laplacian mathematics and Bessel functions. So all those things kind of go round and round. Anyone else with any questions or topics right now before I get to my puzzle? Okay, very well. So for tonight's little puzzle is, we all remember those terrible days of leaded everything. There was lead in the paint, there was lead in the gasoline, there was a lot of lead in our blood, unfortunately, and some people conjecture that the Roman Empire didn't fall because of any political, economic thing, but due to a long, long era of lead poisoning, because they seem to like to use lead pipes for a lot of their very excellent plumbing. Nevertheless, paint is now lead-free. Your car has lead-free gasoline. My question for tonight is if anyone knows of any other place where they're still using leaded gasoline out there. Come on, someone, give me a guess. Something that uses gasoline, obviously. That's not a car, because I told you that it's completely verboten, illegal for a car. So just keep in mind the different things that can run on gasoline, and one of them is running on leaded gasoline these days.
Is that aircraft, piston-type aircraft, Roy?
Yes, indeed. You win the gold star. There's approximately 170,000 aircraft operating today that use a low-lead 100-octane fuel because they feel that they really can't get by on 94-octane. They need 100, and up until recently, the best solution was to put lead ethyl groups in there to bring it up to 100-octane. They're now starting to work on things like manganese compounds that can replace ethyl lead and such. But to this day, there is still lead gasoline being used. It's a very infinitesimal amount. It's something like 0.1% of the gasoline produced. But it still continues. And I always thought that leaded gasoline had gone away 25 years ago.
Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu.
Yes, Rich.
About 20 minutes ago, I was driving home and heard a news item that they're having a tremendous problem with the restoration of Notre Dame because of all the lead in that building. And Paris is on this decontamination project along with just the regular restoration, but it's going to be much longer than they thought it would.
Well, that's the nature of technology. As time goes on, we make assumptions that things are safe and benign because they don't immediately kill us, and then we find out after the fact that causes nerve damage and all kinds of nasty things. Heavy metals are dangerous things. If you don't absorb them biologically, you know, if you lock them away in some kind of shielding or something and you don't come into regular contact, they're not a problem. But if you vaporize them in gas, in leaded gas, or if the children have this unfortunate weird tendency to peel paint and eat it, and the old layers still have the lead paint on it, that hasn't been completely eradicated, then you're in for a population of lead poisoning. Not to mention all the people who get shot these days. You know, we tend to kind of believe in once you get sewed up and the lead shot stays in you, there's nothing wrong with that. But they're finding that a lot of people who have been shot with lead bullets that couldn't be completely removed have an increased serum lead level, which can produce a heel drop and all kinds of neurological deficits. So, unfortunately, we learn slowly. Asbestos was a complete surprise to most people of the problems that produced. So, and no doubt, we are probably in contact with some chemicals and components that are going to be proven to be dangerous to us in the future. That's just the way technology works, unfortunately.
I wonder, Roy, if animals, let's say deer, are shot with lead bullets, and non-lead bullets are such a small percentage of the total amount of bullets, whether they're pure lead or jacketed lead. But I wonder if an animal, if a deer is shot with lead and turned into meat and venison and whatever, could that affect the person eating it?
Oh, if you shoot it and you kill it and then you strip it and you don't eat the lead, which I think most hunters don't do that, you shouldn't have a problem. They did pass some laws about shooting birds because of the way that they shoot birds a lot is they nick a bunch of them and they bring a few of them down. And if you keep nicking them with lead shot, you're going to poison the entire group of birds. So I think there might be some specific rules about shooting birds and such that you have to use either low lead or no lead bullets. But the overwhelming majority of bullets are lead-based. They're inexpensive, and because lead is so dense, they have more momentum to them. So it's going to be a problem to get the lead out of bullets. I'm sure all of you have experienced the joy of lead-free solder, and that's a pain in the backside. other questions, comments, or what have you before I move on to the usual stuff?
KD2HUC with a question.
Yes, KD2HUC.
What is the likelihood of lead affecting underwater groundwater supplies? Because I'm thinking on Long Island alone, there's thousands of miles of lead shielded cable in the ground. What are the chances of that lead making its way, becoming soluble?
That's a very good question. I do not believe there's either been any evidence or any well-published studies that demonstrate that. What has been happening, and I'm sure you keep your eye on the news, it was Flint, Michigan, used a series of lead plumbing lines that basically poisoned their water supply. So directly running water through lead pipes is a definitive no-no. Whether lead in the earth poisons the groundwater, I guess it depends upon the individual places. Like especially around here, we don't really use our groundwater. We use the reservoir system. So that would be an interesting study. I'll have to look into that.
Because here I'm out in Colmack, and here they have wells drilled all over the place. We get our water right out of the ground. It's not coming from a reservoir, so that's why I ask.
Okay, I mean it would be interesting. It's not that much. It's not very difficult to run water samples through different type of devices, a mass spectrometer, and there's loads of equipment that can pick up parts per million. Sometimes that leads to excessive caution because since you can pick up parts per million, parts per billion, you inevitably find results that are not going to have any effect whatsoever to 99.99999% of all human beings or things in general. But because you can measure it, everyone is anxious about it. But I'm sort of surprised in this time and place that water checks on wells aren't somehow mandated by some governmental official.
Pretty well may be. I mean, we do have a municipal water company, but, that's responsible for managing and operating the wells. I would assume that testing is done. But I just, we put this stuff in the ground and, goes everywhere. So, is it only a matter of time before all of a sudden it does start to show up? Just a thought. KD2HUC, back to net.
It's an interesting thought. I mean, my gut sense is that it's probably not a large enough amount of exposure to running water and other factors probably limit its absorption, but it'd be interesting to see if anyone has done any research on something like that. I don't know, if there's a heck of a lot of lead pipe in the ground either. I'm sure there's to a degree lead pipes, but I don't know if they really crisscross that much. But it certainly is an interesting question.
Hey, Bravo Zulu.
Yes, Rich.
East end of Long Island, there's an organization called the Pine Barrens Society, and they're concerned about the lead in the water and the aquifers of the Pine Barrens. And out here, they don't do, if you have your own well, for instance, the towns don't require testing, but if you, I think it's Suffolk County actually, if you request a test of your water, of Suffolk County, they do that testing for free. And because of all the former potato farms, they're very interested in the levels of turmeric, I think it's called.
Okay, I mean, there's all kinds of things that we're pouring down the ground and getting absorbed into the groundwater. Every so often you'll read reports of the concentration of estrogen from female birth control pills that somehow make their way into water supplies and such. So, again, part of it is that we have such accurate ways of measuring infinitesimal portions of things dissolved in our water that we come up with a lot of, not false positives, but we overreact to things that are, you know, a part per billion or so. There's a lot of dangerous chemicals. We play with a lot of chemistry. Life is chemistry, so there's nothing inherently wrong, in my opinion, with chemistry. But there are good chemicals, there are bad chemicals, and we're, as I mentioned before, we're discovering that we didn't caution ourselves. I mean, when I was a kid, I used to regularly, in chemistry labs, saw holes in asbestos for glassware, for chemistry, and breathe in the asbestos particle. We had benzene that we used with all alacrity as solvent that's liver toxic. So back in the 20s and 30s, they had fluoroscopy machines in shoe stores so that you could wiggle your toes and expose your feet to unnecessary x-rays. So we've done all kinds of silly things, and we'll probably continue. Anything further before I go into my little spiel?
Yes, WA2VDH with a question.
Yes, John.
My question is, what are the effects of high levels of iron, dissolved iron, in drinking water? I know New York American Water, out here in Nassau County, they're putting in quite a few plants to do filtering for iron. What are the effects of high levels of iron? Go ahead.
Okay, iron is necessary for human life. It is the most important metal involved in each little hemoglobin molecule in your red blood cells. It's the way that you get oxygen to your body, and with no oxygen, there ain't much life left in anyone. So iron is a good thing, but too much of iron is not a good thing. There are genetic predispositions for absorbing too much iron, and the body has problems getting rid of it once it absorbs it. It can produce a buildup and deposits in such places as the liver, and can eventually promote liver failure. The treatment of choice is kind of surprising. It's kind of a throwback to the good old days when, in doubt, you bled people, because if you have an excess amount of iron stores, the easiest way to deal with that is to simply transfuse red blood cells out of you, because that's where a lot of your iron is, and that's a way of lowering the level. So that's if you have a genetic predisposition. If you have a high iron content in general, you are going to tend to absorb more iron, and it will simulate the genetic disorder as well, which is, again, problematic. It can lead to skin discolorations as well. You get a collection of iron that only belongs in your red blood cells, and it ends up seeping through the rest of your body and causing organ failure.
That's interesting, because the letter from New York American Water only talks about iron staining the various porcelain fixtures in the house. So it's I guess good to have bottled water. But anyway, they are installing a filtration plant not far from my home that is filtering out the excess iron.
The most immediate result that you'll see under those circumstances are the iron stains on your plumbing. You don't see the iron stains in your liver until it's way too late. And you have to have really high levels of dissolved iron in order to have that happen, unless you have that genetic predisposition that overdoes iron accumulation. Only a small percentage of ingested iron is actually absorbed into your body. People take iron supplements all the time, and they get away with it. It's just a matter of how much you take of anything.
HIS query.
Yes, Bill.
I have heard that cornflakes are, quote-unquote, fortified with iron, and that they are fortified by way of the addition of iron filings. Which can be extracted if you happen to have a need for small quantities of iron filings. Is there any thought as to whether or not that would be a way to actually get iron into you, or is that just for marketing purposes, AC2IS?
Personally, I think it's more marketing. I kind of think we go a little bit overboard with adding stuff to things just in case. A lot of things have iodine in it because iodine's important to have, but I don't know if you quite need the amount of iodine that's kind of hidden away. Folic acid is another thing. They enrich flour. They enrich all kinds of things with folic acid. And there are some water-soluble vitamins that if you just eat too much, you just have expensive urine, and there's no real problem. But oil-based vitamins can collect in your body, in the fat cells and the liver cells, and can lead to problems. So I think they're trying to make a point about, you know, one bowl of cereal a day gives you a week supply of iron and other things. And I don't think you need a week supply of iron. I'm not really that aware of too many people who are iron deficient because of dietary restrictions. Hey, this one actually leads very nicely to the first article that I'd like to do tonight. So I'll do it, and we may have a little puzzle after it as well. If you own a lot of stock in nutritional supplement companies, it might be better for your health not to listen to this particular story. There are lots of things that you can do to keep your heart healthy and hopefully live longer. But a new review suggests that most dietary changes and supplements won't move the needle much, if at all. Some supplements might even slightly increase your chances of a stroke. The study published a few weeks ago in the Annals of Internal Medicine are a deep dive into the links between our diet and supplement habits and our cardiovascular health. Its review of 9 past meta-analyses of randomized and controlled clinical trials, as well as 4 other trials, amounted to more than 270 trials involving nearly 1 million volunteers. These trials asked people to try out a total of 24 interventions, such as taking certain supplements or switching to a Mediterranean diet. And then they compared the control groups. On the positive side, the authors found moderately strong evidence that eating less salt, even if your blood pressure is fine, can slightly lower your chances of dying early, including from cardiovascular disease. And they also found that some weak evidence that taking fish oil supplements, which contain omega-3 fatty acids, can lower the risk of heart attacks and heart disease, while folic acid supplementation was associated with a similar chance of stroke. But they found no evidence that taking supplements containing vitamins B6 and A, multivitamins, iron that we mentioned before, and antioxidants led to any change in people's risk of cardiovascular disease or of dying earlier. The same null result was seen with every other dietary change, such as eating less fat, and taking supplements with both calcium and vitamin D was actually linked to a higher risk of stroke. Let me drop for a second. It's not that the first review or study to single out the supplements as being useless for making the average person any healthier, but the findings, the author said, also reflect the dismal state of nutrition science. Most of the trials examined were deemed to be of low quality. They had high risks of bias, or they simply didn't apply to the general population. With folic acid, for instance, the study most responsible for suggesting it can help prevent strokes was conducted in China. But people living in China tend to have lower levels of folic acid to begin with. And since their foods aren't fortified like ours are, you know, the results are kind of dubious. Overall, these findings are limited by suboptimal quality of the evidence, the authors wrote. When it comes to most supplements, though, the message from the authors is clear. Unless you're currently battling scurvy or some other specific deficiency, you generally don't need them. And taking certain supplements in very high dosages, such as vitamin B6, has even been linked to cancer or other health risks. Do not waste your money on these supplements, study author Safi Khan said in a video statement released by the American College of Physicians, which publishes the Annals of Internal Medicine. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra.
WB2GXM.
Yes, Rich.
AC2GS, WB2GXM. Thanks, Roy. I am in the habit from Monday morning through Friday morning of having, let's say, a half bowl of mini wheats mixed in with Cheerios and blueberries. Now, I am pretty sure the mini wheats are fortified with iron, probably the Cheerios too. Do you see problems with that kind of morning diet, WB2GXM?
Probably not, again, because it's not like you're on some strange diet where you have these for breakfast, lunch, and dinner nonstop, endlessly. There was some very weird case of a person in England who went on an all-potato chip diet, which I can't even begin to imagine what that does to a person. But you probably are not going to have any problems, because, you know, it's just one meal a day. But I think marketing has gotten more control of our diet than medical science has, which is not a good thing.
Okay, thank you, Roy. Continue.
Too busy.
Yes, Rich.
This journal that you're quoting from.
Yes. I know the journal, it's the Annals of Internal Medicine.
Oh, I know that, but how esteemed is it? How revered is it?
Oh, I don't exactly know how to do that. Say from 0 to 10, 10 being the New England Journal of Medicine, I would place Annals of Internal Medicine at a 9.5. How's that?
Perfect. You just saved me a lot, and the rest of us a lot of money. You know, the nutraceutical industry, they play on fear, of course. And I know Resveratrol was the hot one for heart a couple of years ago, or in the last 5 years, or 6 years, Resveratrol, what can be found in red wine. But it's all, like you said, and I heard a doctor say, very expensive urine-producing supplements.
Indeed, Rich. And which brings me to part B of my story. Unless someone has any questions or comments, I'll move on to that one. Okay, very well. We live in a very strange era of mankind, an era of ad copy and dubious pseudoscientific research findings. Nutraceuticals are a multi-billion dollar business. A research from a few years ago pegged this at approximately $36 billion a year in the United States alone. And they predicted that the overall money to be made in this field will climb to as high as $278 billion by 2024. So if you guys want to start a business, I guess it's nutraceuticals. Even if these food supplements had any value to anyone but the truly malnourished, often these supplements don't contain much of any of the food supplements they claim to have on their labels. Back in 2015, the New York Attorney General's office revealed that herbal supplements from Walmart, Walgreens, GNC and Target were not what they claimed on their labels. It was revealed that only 21% of the products sold by these four major retailers actually contained plant DNA in them. Walmart had the worst rating with only 4% of their herbal supplements products showing plant DNA when they were tested. The supplements involved in the testing included ginseng, St. John's wort, garlic, jacoba biloba, saw palmetto, echinacea. I always forget how to pronounce that. Tests show that these were contaminated with substances they shouldn't contain, such as rice, beans, citrus, asparagus, pine, wheat, primrose, houseplants, and wild carrots. And in most cases, these unlisted contaminants were the only plant DNA found in the herbal products. Let me drop for a sec. So even if you assume that the poorly designed and carried out studies that might suggest some benefit from these natural products were valid, that's a heck of a lot of fraud already. A lot of research has poured in a lot of cold water all over a lot of these beneficial studies that make the whole thing seem like it might be some big scam hiding in plain sight. But all this is a subject for maybe another night. This is just a preamble to another one of my little puzzlers. Advertising has taught us that artificial is bad and natural is good. Chemicals are bad, organic is good. Yet, all we know that natural wild mushrooms can be very dangerous. Some are quite tasty, but for every expensive truffle, there are mushrooms that can send you on a bad trip like LSD, or worse, a trip to the morgue. Some of the first forms of poison that man discovered and illicitly used were plant-based. Most people are aware of hemlock. It was used on poor Socrates when his fellow Athenians accused him of refusing to recognize gods recognized by the state and of corrupting the youth. There's oleander that contains a toxic type of chemical called a cardiac glycoside, which can actually be therapeutic in small dosages, like the digitalis and foxglove. There's wolfbane, there's castor oil plants that contain the incredibly toxic chemical called ricin. This is all to demonstrate that nature is complicated. It's not terribly benign. And if you trust nature, the nature of the ad agencies too much, you might be in for some trouble down the line. So, some plants are good, some plants are not so good. My question is, are any plants a little bit of both? In other words, are there any plants that we eat parts of, that we enjoy and that's nutritious, that contain other parts that we keep away from us because they could make us sick or even kill us? So that's my question.
Rhubarb.
At a general statement of the world today, or you think rhubarb's a poisonous?
This is N2RDV. Well, actually, the entire rhubarb plant contains oxalates, which it's debatable how good those are for you. They can cause kidney stones in some. But you can eat the stalks of the rhubarb, now the American rhubarb, I mean. The leaves and the roots are highly poisonous and to be avoided. Now, there is something called Indian rhubarb that's used in Indian and Chinese medicine, and the roots of which are highly beneficial, but that's a different species of plant. I'm talking about regular rhubarb, the one you put in strawberry rhubarb pie, or the one that you mix with applesauce and make a pie out of that or whatever.
Okay, and you're quite correct. There are somewhat nutritional foods that have small amounts of compounds that in higher dosages would be very problematic. Something as simple as an almond. A lot of people like almonds. There are sweet almonds. There are bitter almonds. The bitter almonds contain a lot more of a protein that breaks down into hydrogen cyanide. Matter of fact, the aroma of bitter almonds is what people recognize if they ever smell hydrogen cyanide, which is a poison. The good point is that there's so little of the hydrogen cyanide in a sweet almond that you would have to basically eat your weight in sweet almonds in order to kill yourself. And there's lots of different plants that equally contain problematic things, but at low dosages that we can get away with.
Apple seeds, for one.
Indeed. Apple seeds, a lot of seeds are deeply problematic. All of the stone fruits, the peaches, the pears, and such, and tomatoes and even apple seeds contain within them these cyanide organic compounds that can break down to hydrogen cyanide. Fortunately, there's a whole bunch of ways that we don't end up killing ourselves. One is that if the seeds are intact, if you swallow seeds, I don't know if your mother ever gave you the story that a tree is going to grow in your stomach, but usually the seeds are protected against acid digestion. They'll pass right through your body, and so will the cyanide. Also, they're heat labeled. So if you crush them and expose yourself to them, if you heat them up, most of the hydrogen cyanide will escape. So all kinds of seeds are incredibly dangerous, taken to extremes. Peach pits and otherwise. I don't know too many people who eat peach pits, but a lot of people eat the occasional apple seeds. But you would have to eat an enormous number of apple seeds, and you would have to grind them up in order for them to be toxic to you.
N2RDB.
N2RDB.
Yes, well, apricot pits have the controversial substance laetrile in them, which some people believe that is chemotherapy. I'm not willing to ascribe to whether or not I am one of those increasingly hypothetical people over the air, but that's one thing. And apple seeds, of course. Now, almonds are a funny food because if you actually soak them, even the sweet ones, you soak them and, like, peel the skins off and then eat them or use them in cooking, they're actually a lot better for you than if you leave the skins on. Now, I don't really have experience with bitter almonds, but, you know, that's just what I wanted to point out to you.
Yeah, I agree entirely. I think laetrile kind of came and gone. They had as they always do, they had clinics set up in Mexico giving laetrile treatments back in the 80s, but I don't think I've heard laetrile mentioned in at least a decade, so hopefully that's a done deal. There's nowadays all these flim-flam guys are injecting stem cells into everyone. That's the panacea for this week. There are other very similar compounds and fruits and vegetables that have a similar situation that you mentioned, the almonds. Potatoes. Potatoes are great ways of storing starches. So they're tubers, and the potato tuber itself is full of healthy starch. The problem, though, is that if the skin turns green, it's a sign that the cells in the skin are producing a toxic material, and the plants themselves are toxic. If you were to kind of chew on a potato plant or a potato seed or a potato fruit or a potato leaf, you would probably get sick. And that's why it's suggested that people shouldn't eat the skin of green potatoes, because it's not that the chlorophyll is the problem, but it's a sign that the solanil produced by the potato plants are going to give you a problem. And one of the ways of getting rid of it is if you boil it up or you fry it, you kind of get rid of most of that stuff in the water, as long as you don't drink the water too. So it's very similar. So there's a lot of things that we eat that can be dangerous if we do the wrong things with them, but thankfully most people either know enough to not do it or just by habit alone wouldn't consider doing it. I mean, most people don't really look happy if they see that their potato has turned green.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
in regard to the potato, doesn't that cause skin problems? You know, I know when I was younger, my mother would not peel a potato. She'd give it to anybody else, you know. Give it to me, anybody, but, you know, unless they were wearing gloves, you know, to protect themselves. Is that a different chemical than what you were just talking about with the green potato?